Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Jeff Meehan, who graduated in 2015 with a JD from Suffolk University Law School and MBA from Suffolk University Sawyer Business School. He published an article in the spring 2014 edition of the Sports Lawyers Journal that we're going to be discussing today. He currently works as a risk management associate and head of the risk analytics team at Robert M. Curry & Associates, an independent consulting firm. So welcome, Jeff, and to start off, can you just introduce yourself so we can better get to know you?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show. Like you said, you hit all the bare bones. I did came up to Boston with aspirations of being a sports agent, so I went to law school for the legal side of the business and went to get an MBA in order to handle the actual contract negotiations and kind of get a feel for the market side of things. While I was here, I got a chance to intern with the Boston Red Sox, which is still by far the funnest job I've ever had, even as a Yankees fan.
Yeah, no, that's great.
Yeah, that was a fun interview process. I get in there and tell him I'm a Yankees fan, and the guy goes, "Well, that's nice. People can change." And just went through, just graduated law school this past May, took the New York and Massachusetts bar exams, and just ready to roll. Had another article published last year, and right now I'm doing some consulting work for a local commercial real estate firm.
Well, great. Yeah, sounds like you have a broad base of experience, and that's great. So thanks for coming on the podcast. Today we're going to be talking about an article that you wrote in the spring 2014 edition of the Sports Lawyers Journal. It's entitled "Harvard or Hardball: An Examination of Ethical Issues Faced by Lawyer Agents." So to start off, can you just provide us with a background of your article and of how the sports agency business works a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote the article in order to get a better understanding of the business as a whole, and I didn't realize when I came up here that there were a lot of ethical things that lawyers are held to that all the laypersons in the sports agent business don't have to adhere to at all, and that it's done through the model rules of professional conduct. Sports agents have been around forever. I think the first one on record is back in 1920, but they never really took off until the 60s, 70s, 80s when sports started becoming big business. The rise of sports agents kind of coincide with the rise of TV deals and leagues becoming what they are today. The sports agent today is typically done through one of the larger firms in the industry, as they have all the relationships and the resources built up that the modern athlete is looking for. And to give you a little perspective on that, on just how far the industry's come, when I was researching the article, in 1980, the average MLB player made $400,000 in 2012 dollars. In 2012, that average was up to $3.4 million. So that's just to give you a little bit of scope of how far things have come in terms of the money on the table.
And that provides an incentive for people to want to be agents.
Exactly. People look at that and they see, I want a slice of that pie, and I get to work in sports. I get to be close to athletes. And people think it's a much more glamorous job than I think it actually is, unless you're at the top.
Okay. And in your article, you talk about things that make it difficult to become an agent, and that's why a lot of these agents tend to be parts of big agencies, big firms.
Exactly. There's a lot of startup costs that people don't think about when you're becoming an agent. And this is things that all agents are subject to. This isn't just lawyer agents, but the main thing is getting a client list. I mean, you can be the smartest guy in the world, but if the next 21, 22-year-old LeBron James doesn't want you to do any of his negotiations for him, then you don't have a job. You don't have a meal ticket. It's that simple. And once you actually get a player, if you can get to the negotiation table, negotiate a contract, there's still a chance that one of the bigger fish in the industry can come to your player and say, "Hey, I know X and X did your rookie contract. Well, we think you did a poor job. And given our history and stuff, we can show that we can get you X times more, and we have a lot more resources at our disposal to allow you to become a better player and earn even more money throughout your career." The client list is one of the main things that the sports agent has to go through when starting up. The other things you have to consider are just the financial investment. I've got a couple of friends who tried to do this right out of college, and they spent thousands of dollars on plane tickets and travel. And if you don't have a client, you don't have any money coming in. So it's just a very tough business to get into if you don't have any startup capital involved. Then you have other issues such as race and gender. It's a lot of little tiny things involved on top of all the bigger stuff that you have to keep track of. For example, there really aren't as many black or not other non-white agents in sports as there really should be, or female agents. There's one of the most prominent female agents is here in Boston, and she used to represent Doug Flutie. And talking to her, I've heard that it takes a lot for her to be taken seriously at the negotiation table because it's generally been an all-boys club. And so you're dealing with all these different issues, and then on top of that, you have these bigger firms using their ethical marketing practices, and then you have other agents on your level using unethical practices, such as payments and other kind of cash handouts in order to induce the client to come to their agency and leave you. So I know it was a little long-winded, but it's very difficult for someone to just kind of walk off the street and say, I'm going to be a sports agent, if they don't have something to their advantage right away.
Yeah, no, I've seen that as well. Well, just talking to people about their careers and stuff, it's definitely tough out there to start as a sports agent from the ground up, for sure. Okay, so let's move on and talk about, you know, why lawyers are different. What kind of laws govern sports agents and the industry as a whole?
So the laws of governing sports agents are one of the things that a lot of scholars and a lot of people who look at the industry, that's one of their main gripes, is that there's a lot of different areas, agencies governing the business, and there's nothing really uniform about it. All agents are subject to various state laws, such as breach of contract, agency theory, but in terms of the sports agent business, there's really only a couple of specific laws. One being the Uniform Athlete Agent Act, which is in place as a way to kind of keep track of who is a sports agent and keep track of sports agent registration. It's very broad and it's not mandatory. States can either adopt it or keep their own agent regulation laws or have none at all. The majority of states at this point have adopted some form of the Uniform Athlete Agent Act, which all it really does is makes agents sign up to say, hey, I'm an agent. I've represented a couple of clients. This is who they are. And it just puts people on notice that they are actually recognized as an agent by the state. The other law that's really prominent in the sports agent field is the Sports Agent Responsibility and Trust Act, also known as SPARTA, which Congress enacted in 2004. Its purpose was to codify the duties of a sports agent, and it gives a federal cause of action to the student and the state and also the educational institution that has a cause of action against the agent when the agent does something wrong. For example, if the agent signs a student before his eligibility is up, the student loses eligibility and the school loses the student as one of its, I don't want to say employees because that's a touchy subject, but as one of its football players. And so it gives the school a chance to go after the agent also. And it's those kind of things that SPARTA is really designed to do. It's supposed to be very, very narrow. And other than that, you're looking at regulations enacted by different leagues in order to become an agent there just to get that certification. For the NFL, I believe it's you have to have a undergraduate degree and a master's degree from an accredited institution, or you can get that waived upon showing 7 years of negotiation experience. And that's kind of been the high bar for leagues. It's been very minimal across the actual professional leagues in terms of what it takes to become an agent.
Okay. And these laws or these regulations, these affect all agents, not just lawyer agents, right?
These are laws across the board for all agents. And it's just, it makes things more difficult for the small upstart agent to really get his feet wet. Because if you have, think about it, if you have to register in every state that you want to be an agent, a big firm, that's nothing. It might be $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, but big firm, that's chump change. To the startup agent with one or two clients, that's going to eat into his profits quite a bit.
Okay. So this backdrop of laws and regulations, this potentially creates more obstacles to startup agents, including lawyer agents.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Well, great. So now we have that backdrop. Let's move on and In your article, you argue that lawyer agents face additional barriers to entry. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. The lawyer agent is subject to what's known as the model rules of professional conduct, which the American Bar Association put in place because they want lawyers to be held to a higher ethical standard than your common layperson. They think that a layperson's going to put more trust into a lawyer just based on that title alone. And based on the title, they want the lawyer to be more ethical. So there's certain rules that a lawyer has to follow, even if he's not acting as a lawyer, such as the solicitation of clients, certain conflicts of interest scenarios, competency, and how he charges his clients for his services, which a non-lawyer agent just doesn't have to worry about. So, for example, when soliciting clients, a lawyer can't have any face-to-face communication the first time he tries to solicit his services. A non-lawyer can go right up to an athlete and pitch him directly and offer his services to him. The lawyer agent can't do that. It has to make sure the first communication is by mail, email, one of those other methods, which just simply isn't as impactful. So getting clients, which is the main barrier to entry for all agents, is slightly more difficult for the lawyer agent than the non-lawyer agent. Also, You have certain scenarios where lawyers are faced with conflicts of interest. So the typical agent is going to run into this scenario a lot where he has multiple clients and there's only so many roster spots available across various leagues. The regular agent can just try to get as much money for his clients as possible without worrying about the recourses of it. However, if one of the lawyer agent's clients aren't happy with the situation or the outcome of the negotiations or his placement, he can go after his agent under the model rules of professional conduct because the lawyer's charged with being a zealous advocate for him. And it's hard to be a zealous advocate when you have two or three clients all vying for the exact same spot.
Right, especially in a league that has a salary cap or something like that.
There's only so much money to go around.
Okay.
There's other small issues such as competency, where missing a filing deadline won't do anything to a non-lawyer agent, but a lawyer agent could also be subject to recourse under the MRPC, such as when Terrell Owens' agent missed the filing deadline for him to be a free agent. And lastly, one of the bigger things that a lawyer agent's subject to is fees. Now, the regular sports agent makes most of his bones in marketing, where he takes a percentage of the actual contract value. The lawyer agent has to charge what is known as a reasonable fee, and that's subjective based on the industry. But for perspective, a regular lawyer might charge 10% on Jordan's last contract with Nike for 3 weeks of work and might make $300,000 as a flat fee. If David Falk took 5% of Jordan's contract value every year, he makes almost $3 million a year for a couple weeks of negotiating.
So that potentially could be an unreasonable fee.
Yeah, it potentially could subject Falk to punishment under the MRPC, which it shouldn't, but it's something that is possible given the way the industry and the law is set up.
Are you aware of cases where some contingency fee like that was found to be unethical in an agent situation?
I hadn't when I was researching the article. I don't know if there's any recently. This is one of those areas that hasn't been dived into very much. From a law perspective, it's one of those things that hasn't really been written about. So that's kind of why the article got a lot of traction. It's an issue that could come up a lot, but hasn't yet.
Yeah, and these rules of professional conduct that are set up to, you know, ensure that lawyers are ethical and things like that, a lot of times they use these terms like a reasonable fee and stuff, and it's not exactly clear what that means in the agent context, right? That's kind of the problem created by the rules.
Correct. It's very subjective, and what's deemed unreasonable in one industry isn't unreasonable in another. Like, David Falk probably should be able to charge more for a marketing contract than you or I could if we were representing somebody, just because he's been doing it a long time and he has the connections to make sure the product is just that much better at the end. But a judge could see it differently.
Right. Okay. Anything else you want to discuss about the rules of professional conduct?
That's really kind of the big stuff. There's also Article 5 issues, so Model Rule 5, where you're subject to punishment as a lawyer, stuff people underneath you do, and subject to stuff that your business partners do. So if you're an agent and you want to hook up with another agent to do some work just to expand your business a little bit, you have no problems. You can just go right ahead and do it. As a lawyer agent, you're not allowed to share fees with a non-lawyer, and you're liable liable for all of the damage caused by people working under you or within your business. So it makes it a little more difficult for lawyer agents to team up and kind of build that conglomerate brand like David Falk has or any of the other big businesses have. Again, it's an issue that might not come up, and if it does come up, it's kind of swept under the rug, but it's one that just makes it a little more difficult for a lawyer agent to start up than a non-lawyer agent.
Okay. So, yeah, you've identified a whole host of potential issues that come from lawyers being subject to these rules of professional conduct that other agents aren't. Also, in your article, you came up with some proposed solutions rather than just naming a bunch of problems. Would you like to discuss those and how you think those could help solve these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of ways that a lot of people have approached solving the agent issue. One of them was just giving a little more bite back to the actual laws. So the UAA and SPARTA don't really have that much in terms of recourse. They're subject to some fines and little penalties, but it really becomes a risk-reward decision when you're looking at an agent talking about giving payments to athletes or doing something unethical. And the way I approached my proposed solution was I wanted to tip the risk-reward calculation in favor of not doing the unethical conduct, and from both the agent and the player side. So one of the things I liked was Scott Boras proposed giving fines up to $1 million to the agent for violations of the UAA and SPARTA. That might be a high number, but something certainly more substantial than the $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 fines that are out there right now. The other thing I wanted to see was holding the actual athletes accountable and making them think twice about what they're doing. And the solution I came up with was potentially keeping them out of the league for 1 year if they were one of the parties involved in this violation. Now, that might need to be a little more ironing out on that because, I mean, they are kids and they will make mistakes, but you have to at least make them understand that, hey, you're 18, 19, 20 years old and you need to be held accountable for your actions, and we're not just going to give you a free pass just because you're a kid. So if you can tilt that risk-reward factor for UAA and SPARTA violations in favor of not doing unethical conduct, then I think you have a better shot of actually enforcing the laws. And the other thing I wanted to see was some sort of recruitment and solicitation guidelines, putting everybody on the same field as far as their client list is concerned. I wanted to see some kind of agent selection period in college. I use college football as an example in the article, and I wanted to see some kind of agent selection period similar to a recruitment week where all agents come in at the same time and meet the player, greet the player, give their pitch, and the player selects agents while still in school under the guidance of his coaches and school administrators. And I wanted to see that process available for people who would become eligible to be drafted next year, not just this year, so they can establish relationships and legal relationships, and then they would be less likely to take advantage of payments and handouts from unethical agents. Also, and this was kind of my kicker to it, I wanted to give more stringent penalties to people who tried to violate that agent-player contract. So if you had someone who was under contract with an agent for their first negotiation and you were soliciting the client, I wanted there to be more strict penalties for that kind of behavior on the agent side in terms of a fine or a suspension or even a loss of your right to be an agent. I looked at it as the risk-reward factor right now favors doing unethical conduct just because of all the barriers to entry, and I thought something along this line would tilt that sort of thought process in the mind of both the agent and the player and make things a little more ethical.
Okay, so it seems like kind of the unifying idea between all these proposed solutions is trying to either increase penalties for any kind of agent that commits violations and trying to level the playing field between lawyers and non-lawyers.
Yeah, that's the essence of all the laws and solutions that I've seen from everybody else. That's the goal, is to put everyone on the same field and to make it ethical for agents and athletes alike. I focused on leveling the playing field between the lawyer agent and the non-lawyer agent. And I think one of the main things that separates those two is the solicitation guidelines that allow one to grow the business at a much faster rate than the other. And I think if you level that out, you give a chance for a lot more ethical people to be in the agent industry.
Right. And yeah, I know, like, I just graduated from law school and exploring the rules of professional conduct. I don't think anybody would say that they're perfect. You know, there's a lot of things that need to be looked at in as far as their practical effect and how they affect real world lawyers. And so sports agents are not unique in that aspect of being perhaps having the practice of their actual profession being hurt by these rules. Although, of course, the purpose is good. You want to have ethical lawyers, but perhaps there's side effects that are negative.
Of course, exactly. And that's actually a really big issue, is you're only subject to the MRPC if you're actually practicing law. And no one's really answered that question of whether a sports agent is practicing law. And that's one that I've looked at in the past, and I don't think there is a concrete answer in the law yet. But I think that's one that's a discussion that's going to be ripe for the taking very soon.
Well, great. I think that that covers everything or most of what was in your article. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to record this podcast. I think it's been a great discussion. Is there anything else you'd like to say to kind of close this up?
Not really. Peter, I think we hit everything pretty head on, and I know I droned on a little bit there, but I want to say thanks for having me on the podcast. We'll be back for another if you want.
Yeah, no, we'd love to have you, and if people are interested in reading this article, they can go to the spring 2014 edition of the Sports Lawyers Journal. It sounds like you've written another one. What's that one about?
My latest article is about daily fantasy sports and establishing the legality of them under gambling laws, and it'll be out in the Marquette Sports Law Review in January 2016.
Okay. Yeah, and daily fantasy sports, anybody who watches football, you know, you see more advertisements for daily fantasy sports than you see actual football games. So okay. It's certainly a big issue right now.
Mm-hmm. Especially when someone's going to win $2 million this weekend off of DraftKings, it kind of becomes a hot topic.
Right. Okay, well, great. Yeah, that's a conversation for another day. But yeah, thanks for coming on the Sports Lobbyist Podcast.
Thank you, Peter.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is at Lieb Montoya in both places. That's at L-I-B Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, at PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, at SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.